welcome to Rise of the Rulelords Unchained. It's your strange and unusual Rulelord Pete, and today I have our first ever returning guest. I'm very excited to reintroduce Mark Seifter, Director of Game Design for Battlezoo Bestiary by Roll for Combat. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing well, Pete. Thanks.
I was really excited to see you again at PaizoCon, and I'm really excited to see another Kickstarter that you guys are releasing to take away my hard-earned money.
Well, we hope that it is a wise way to spend your money in a way that will make a lot of fun for your dollar.
I'm sure it will be. So there are three exciting big products that we're going to talk about today. The Battlezoo Bestiary, Strange and Unusual, The Year of Monsters, and then the Eldamon. So as the consummate game master, I first want to talk to you about the Strange and Unusual Battlezoo Bestiary, which looks like it is comprised of the RPG Superstar 2021 winners, which seems to mean that there's going to be 137 new monsters. Is that right?
More than that. Steven says it's going to be more than 150. The reason for that is that if you won platinum or above, it becomes sort of a family or a group of related creatures. And so it's going to get to somewhere just above 150 monsters, apparently.
Awesome. So we can already see all of these winning monsters on RPGSuperstar.com, but they're going to get the Mark Seifter polish up before publishing, as well as some cool artwork.
Since we'll keep up the undesigned past monsters, you'll be able to see a before and after. Mm-hmm. You haven't been able to see that up until now because the original Battlezoo Bestiary was the only book that was put out under the Battlezoo brand before I was director of game design at Battlezoo, so I did not do a pass on those monsters. Patrick Reaney, senior developer for Paizo, did.
Even more reason to be excited for it. So I wanted to ask you, when you were coming up with the concept Strange and Unusual, what were you looking for when people were submitting these new creature ideas to you?
So that's a great question. And basically, anything, like whatever people thought was strange and unusual. Whenever anyone asked, we didn't clarify because we didn't want just one kind of strange or unusual. Like if one person thinks, oh, you know, whatever, it has to have a million tentacles or it's not strange and unusual. We don't want like all of them tentacles. So we wound up with things that were strange and unusual in a lot of different ways. Just to me, at least, and there were a lot of judges overall, but to me, if it just felt strange or unusual by any definition, it would count. But if it was something that was like, this is a goat, it's a goat. Or like, this is an animal and like it does one thing. Like maybe it is a dog and it breathes fire. Like that wasn't that strange and unusual. But
sure.
Anything that like went outside the ordinary was.
What are some that for people who haven't looked through the contest winner entries or ones you think they should be keeping their eyes out for when they get their hands on the book?
Well, certainly any of them that won a gold or above are really, really good.
Like the Possibility Golem.
Well, the Possibility Golem was pretty interesting. That one like can sort of be in a lot of places at once, and you don't know where it's going to actually be until you like fully sort of lock it down. It's almost like a quantum monster in some ways. There's also some other interesting ones. Let's see. So like the grand prize winner was pretty great. That is the Chiralis, which is basically, if you've ever seen the fact that vampires don't have a reflection, well, right, their missing reflection is the sort of the pitch for the Chiralis. So, like, what are the stats of its missing reflection? What does it do? And it's sort of like a strange two-dimensional reflection-y thing that is very, very interesting and has a lot of possibilities for a family and other things. Let's see. Here's some other gold and platinum winners. There's the Cadavalier that's like a corpse plus the horse that they were riding on sort of combined into one undead. The Coppersmith, which is a fey construct that looks like it's like cooking implements, but they can combine together into a construct that can attack. Let's see, there was the Guiltbound, which is another one of those undead that's made out of two things. This one is a killer and their victim, and it has some interesting abilities, such as the fact that it can only see someone who has killed a sapient creature, and it can only hear or smell, or and all of its senses only work if you've killed a sapient creature. So some settlements that don't have anyone who's done that, like, don't mind having one around, because if somebody murders someone, it'll only go after them. So there's some weird and interesting monsters in here.
So what kind of stuff might we see from the strange and unusual book, like we did from the Last Battle Zoo Bestiary? Are some of these going to be turned into playable ancestries, or might they be in like adventure down the line, kind of like Indigo Isle? Or are we just going with what's in the current Kickstarter for right now?
So we're not going to speculate about future products that might involve any of them, but what I can tell you is that there's a bunch of other stuff that's in the book. Just like for the Last Battle Zoo Bestiary, I mean, the thing I did on that was that I had to redo the entire economy for PF2 multiple times so that you could do monster part crafting using multiple different variants depending on how much you wanted it to work in your game. Mm-hmm. Turns out a lot of people like that. So we're going to put in new options for the monster parts crafting system. People said it's good, but what if there were even more choices? So we're going to make sure to include, for example, imbued properties for any of the Eldamon elements that we wind up getting into the Kickstarter that don't have them yet, which air, earth, and water are ones that we know are going to be in there that don't have an imbued property yet, but there could be more. Also, some new weird and unusual ones, like the very tentacular extension imbued property. So there's going to be some more properties and rules for you if you like the monster parts crafting system. There's also the aberrant soul archetype, which will do kind of what it says on the tin. It's for someone who may be slowly transforming into an aberration. That's pretty strange and unusual too.
Sure.
And like last time, there will be like a small smattering of like character backgrounds and magic items that are directly linked to the monsters.
Got new beasts, new families, new monster parts, and new archetype for Strange and Unusual. We're just going to have to see what more gets brought up when Superstar 2022 comes out, which I'm sure is going to be based off of the mundane and expected. So we'll
I can tell you what that one's going to be based off of. That's already been announced. So the theme is based off of Eldamon, which is one of the other products that's going to be in this Kickstarter. And they're sort of, as we'll talk about later, elemental creatures that really like to phase into objects and creatures and locations that are related to their elements. And by elements, right, I don't mean earth, fire, air, and water only. I mean things like death and life are in there. And if we hit our stretch goals, music and time. So awesome. The theme of the next RPG Superstar is monsters that are related to the 10 to 20 elements from Eldamon that an Eldamon would like hanging out and sort of melding into. So that doesn't mean that you're making an elemental, right? You could make a fae who loves music and it's related to the music element, or like some kind of like very metallic creature that's related to the metal element. So it's a very broad theme that, because it's pretty easy to be related to one of those 20 elements, that's sort of what RPG Superstar 2022 is going
to
be.
Ooh. So game designers, start thinking about what you want to put in for that one. I'm really excited to see what entries get added to that one. Let's talk about the Year of Monsters. So you've made a couple of really exciting announcements on Twitter, on the Pathfinder 2e subreddit, for a bunch of different ancestries. And I'm going to count them down. Tell me if I miss any at the end. So we've got slimes, Sthenos, which are like Medusas, gremlins, nymphs, onis, minotaurs, doppelgangers, demons, and the embodiment of dungeons, which you've already released, but you're going to up them up a little bit, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Did I miss any of the ones
that you've already intelligent weapons?
I haven't seen that announcement, so no. Intelligent weapons is also going to be
one? They were part of the initial announcement. So in order of announcement, it was demons, gremlins, intelligent weapons, and dungeons expanded were announced at launch. And then in order, we announced Oni, Nymphs, Doppelgangers, then Minotaurs, Slimes, and Sthenos.
Wow. That is a lot of awesome sounding ancestries.
Let me tell you the 11th one, though.
Oh, do it.
How about that? People who are subscribed to the newsletter, which is on eldamon.com and gets all the info pretty much as soon as possible. Plus, we'll have details on how to join the playtest on there. But they might already know. But the 11th ancestry is Mimic.
Mimic. Oh, boy. The Mimic. Dreaded Mimic. Yes. So, wow. How did you guys come up with this concept to start having more ancestries based off of, you know, creatures that usually players are fighting?
So there are these big three things that Steven wanted to do, which were Monster Part Crafting, Eldamon, and he even had the name Battle Zoo for over 20 years because he wanted to do something like this. And he waited until the right time when there was Pathfinder 2nd Edition, which he wanted to do it in, and it's not too hard to convert it to 5e, which is very popular right now, too. Plus, he had me, so he has also the third thing that I haven't said that are his three big things. But my big thing that I told him, even when I wasn't working for him directly, was that doing a dragon ancestry I thought was cool. Mm-hmm. And so he decided to just add it to the first Kickstarter. I thought it was going to be like a follow-up thing that we did later, maybe like a PDF that was 20 pages and we could do later expansions if it was popular. But it soon ballooned into
its own thing.
It doubled like every time because he was like, no, we can do all of them. And I was like, okay, that'll be like 40 to 50 pages, just an ancestry with some archetypes. So he was like, all right. And then it went into the Kickstarter and it was announced as a hardcover. And I was like, well, it doesn't say how many pages it is, but you can't do a hardcover that's 40 to 50 pages. And he says, well, you know, I'm sure you can write enough pages for a hardcover, right? And I said, I can. I easily can. I have a lot of content for it, so I did. And that was all very unexpected. But
yeah.
After that point, I told him, hey, people like this. I think we can do more kinds of ancestries. And he wasn't sure. But after he suggested to do dungeons as an April Fool's joke, and just how much people like that, he was like, no, you know what? I'm coming around to the idea of doing these ancestries, and he decided to go for it. So, like, initially, Year of Monsters and Eldamon both weren't going to be the things for this year at all. Year of Monsters came relatively close to when we first started announcing what the things were. Like, it was only a few months before. So, at that point, like, we had some lists that Steven had come up with and some lists that I had come up with and some criteria, and we got down to 12. It was very difficult. There were several that were good runners up, potentially, and that's how we did it.
Wow. So, it sounds like you have a really interesting setup for how you're going to be releasing these monsters after the Kickstarter. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. It's pretty strange and unusual. It's maybe a little unique. So basically, we're making 2023 the Year of Monsters. And what that means is if you sign on for Year of Monsters, then every month you're going to get a monster PDF. And also, there's one Foundry module. You automatically get it when you are in the Year of Monsters, when you back the Year of Monsters. Like, if you're buying everything separately at the bottom as add-ons, you have to buy them separately. But if you back the normal tier, you get it automatically. It's one module, so you don't have to install 12. And the module automatically updates itself every month. At the same time, when you get your PDF, you also get your Foundry integration all in one.
Sounds shockingly like the Paizo subscription.
Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of like that in some ways, although it's less of a subscription because it's more of a one-time purchase because Not only is that happening once every month, we're having special streams for people. It's like sort of a club, like a book a month club, because you can go to the stream, talk about it, talk about the fact maybe you've played it by that point when we have the stream, you've read it, you know what's in there. And some of the stretch goals are going to let us expand certain of those sections. Some of them are, at least one or two of them are very, very early in the stretch goals. We'll expand some of the ancestries, like as soon as the fourth stretch goal period on the project is an expansion for one of them. So what those streams and other venues will allow people to do is tell us what like, how do you want those extra pages to be used? Mm-hmm. And there will be a compilation plus book at the end that is not just compiling everything we've seen so far into one giant PDF or hardcover if you want the hardcover of it, but also adding in all of the extra expansions based on what people who already know and have played the class from the sort of club have determined should be in there.
People get to be involved in the design of this.
Yeah, it's like being part of a little design club. You get the first part of it. And for some of the ancestries, that's going to be almost all that's released. But that doesn't mean that we won't like adjust and errata things afterwards. We always do that with Kickstarters, unlike most publishers like Paizo that aren't based around Kickstarter, where you'll have to wait until the book is ready to come in from the printer before you get your PDF. Mm-hmm. We'll give you the PDF immediately. As soon as we even tell the printer that we have it, you have it too. And that way, if you find any errata, then we will fix it. Like Steven will pay the printer to just change it in the middle and take out that page and put in something else.
So
and
when you get the book, everything's going to be right by the time that you
that's
get it.
Right. That's I like it for me as a customer. That's my style because I always want like the first edition special book. Right. But I also want it to be right and not have errors in it. So this way that will happen. Even if you're not getting Year of Monsters, that's how we roll in general.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm exactly the same way. I actually paid a bookbinder to put the special edition PF2 cover on the second printing of the core rule book so I could have my nice book, but have it be the new rules. And then Paizo goes and announces its recent bit of errata. So that book's now out of date, too, I guess. But that's right. As far as I'm going to go.
But
so,
you sort of get what would be the second printing at Paizo, kind of. On the first printing is just the way we do things. And with Year of Monsters, it'll be even easier to do that. Because in some cases, the first ancestries will be like, it'll be like 11 months since those ancestries came out. So there'll be a lot of time for feedback and for errata to trickle through.
Yeah. So are these also going to be like a little kind of soft covers, like the old campaign things, or is it going to be PDFs and then the big hardcover when it's all compiled?
Your only option to get a physical book is the compilation. I mean, you get it all when you sign up to for the tier, but that's because shipping it to you 12 times would cost you too much money.
Right. That would be
it would be ridiculously expensive for you. And so the monthly aspect of it is the Foundry and you get Foundry, you get the PDF, and on the tier, you also get all the digital assets. In fact, all of the tiers. Someone asked this on the PF2 subreddit, is like, is there going to be a way to, as an add-on, get the digital assets? And if you buy the tiers that are listed, rather than going a la carte and picking up a few things, they always come with the digital assets as well.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about these ancestries and what's going to make them really unique. Just give us like a little preview of what should make someone really excited to play one of these. So let's start off with the demon, the one that I was kind of like, oh, whoa, they went there. So what's going to be cool and unique about playing a demon with your ancestry?
Well, I think just a lot of people want to play demons.
Sure.
Just it's very popular. It's a major like power fantasy archetype for people is to play demons. And like the idea with this ancestry is, you know, demons in like the Pathfinder rules, just right in their stats, they're formed of sin. Mm-hmm. They're usually doomed to an eternity of evil, but some demons may turn their back on their abyssal power source to forge their own destinies.
Mm-hmm.
So as a demon PC, you might call yourself redeemed. Maybe you find the term redeemed to be demeaning and mm-hmm. like, well, I didn't have to be redeemed. I'm just doing my own thing. And sure. you might choose your own path. Even if it leads you back to evil, at least that was your choice. And it wasn't just something that's baked into you by the power of sin. So you're denying the power of the abyss within you. And at first, that's a struggle because, well, like that's your power source. But eventually, especially like for most types of demon, like if you're not like a Balor or something, you get way stronger this way by focusing in on yourself and improving yourself rather than just indulging in sin and kind of being stagnant.
So is it possible then to be a lawful good demon?
You could. Like, it's probably extremely unlikely for you to be one because you not only have to cast off that sin, but you repudiate it as much as possible. Like, maybe you had cast off the sin and you're like, okay, I've done that. I'm still chaotic evil. I'm on my way out, though. And then someone put one of those helms of opposite alignment on you and you're suddenly lawful good. And you're like, actually, this is really great. I like this.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay lawful good. So, I mean, I don't know. But or you just had a really extreme extreme experience. Like
mm-hmm.
maybe you went up to neutral good because of a connection with, if you're playing in Golarion, with like Shellen or Saren Rey or Arche or one of those deities who teaches you to express yourself and find the beauty in things. And you went to neutral good from that, which was hard enough. And then you've been falling back into chaos. So you realize you need more discipline in your life to become lawful so that you don't, kind of slip, and then you become lawful good.
That would be like quite a character arc.
You write your own story.
Yeah.
Yep.
So how about gremlins? I mean, in the art, like they look like the ones from, you know, that really cool movie. So I also have to ask, is there a cute version of them?
So if you've seen gremlins like across the art style from Pathfinder, they're a big family of creatures. There's like how many of them at this point? Like maybe 10 gremlins mm-hmm. in Pathfinder 2nd edition. There, I think were several more that never got converted into 2nd edition from 1st edition. Well, there were exactly 10. I can't believe it. there's all sorts of different visages that in many cases, maybe some people would call cute. I mean, there's a lot of varying definitions on what's cute and what's not cute, and who am I to judge? But in general, gremlins are not known for being like extremely cute, but some people may find them cute. In general, they like tinkering and messing with things. General mm-hmm. gremlins cause all sorts of mischief, misfortune, cursed items, and traps, and things like that. But for an adventuring gremlin, like you may have decided you were going to put your talents to use, wreaking havoc on, you know, the foes of your adventuring party rather than just whoever happens to stumble into the area that day. And so you might just still use all your gremlin hijinks and, you know, build snares or be an inventor with like explosions and just the kind of, or like a thaumaturge doing weird stuff with magic items, just the kind of things you already expected gremlins to do. Or you might just be like a gremlin, like black sheep of the gremlin family, who's just like, no, I wanted to create things instead of tearing them down, even though I was a Vexgit gremlin and my family never understood that desire. But then I tried to explain it. You can create something that can tear even more things down, like a bulldozer.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to have a lot of tinkering sort of powers and abilities, it sounds like, from this ancestry.
Or that, or luck, or like curses. Those are the kinds of things that gremlins are known for.
Mm.
And they're different from the different types of gremlins, right? Because there's like Pugwampies have an unluck aura, and Mitflits are kind of the really weak ones that have lost most of their powers. And Jinkins are the ones who like work together to curse a magic item. Whereas like Vexgits are the ones who are going to like make snares and like sabotage and break your stuff. So there's all sorts of different heritages, and they each do something else.
Then next one I want to talk about is the doppelganger, which sounds like something that people who like to play rogues or, you know, real cloak and daggers are really going to want to gravitate towards. So what cool features is the doppelganger going to feature?
Well, you know, there's not much that sows distrust in your group as a GM more than just making a slight hint that a doppelganger might be around.
Yeah.
And then they all start looking at each other. But some doppelgangers kind of defy the expectation of being a sociopathic shapeshifter who's going to replace your party members and kill you. As an adventurer, you might seek to understand and forge your own identity. Or you might even try to get the world to recognize your identity as an open doppelganger. Or it might be that they think you're some kind of a human that you kind of use as a cover identity. Or, you know, you could also be a sociopathic shapeshifter if you want, like, that's up to you, but you have more options than just that,
right?
And as a doppelganger, you're all about shapeshifting. So when you're just starting out as a doppelganger, you're not one of those who have become like established in the rut of the like the monster entry where it's like, ah, yes, they're you know, they're enticed into just convoluted schemes and sociopathically killing everybody. And you're not like that yet. You've just started out. You can do your shapeshifting, but it's not necessarily as flawless as those older doppelgangers. But before long, you're going to be completely outshining them, because they're like, what, a level 3 monster?
Yeah, usually not all that powerful. And then right. The last one that I'll bug you about, and then everyone else has to go to the Kickstarter to find out some more information about them, is the intelligent weapon that you mentioned. So player who selects this, are they only going to ever have the one weapon option, which is themselves?
Well, they're definitely not going to be able to not use themselves. But there could be options, for example, for shifting, like the shifting rune into a different weapon. Mm-hmm. And they also, I could see two-weapon fighting being a thing, where it's two-weapon fighting with yourself and if you're a one-handed weapon and some other one-handed weapon. So that could be an option. Or self plus shield could be another thing. So depending on what your heritage is and how your situation is, there's all sorts of stories out there for anything, no matter how weird it is. Even if it's an intelligent weapon, there are stories about intelligent weapon protagonists or antagonists. Right. And we're going to let you tell all those different kinds of stories. So some of them like kind of form their own body to hold them. So we're going to have that. And I think it's like Soul Edge and Soul Calibur does both that and mind control of somebody to be the wielder. So we've got like that kind of situation in general. Most like non-evil intelligent weapons have found like a body that was like in a coma or otherwise was unresponsive. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a symbiotic bond where you have someone who you were just like a regular intelligent weapon and not a PC, but then the other person was in trouble and they would have died, and you've bonded together and you're sort of two but one at the same time and helping each other out. And there's all sorts of different sort of heritages that explore into what your connection with your partner is. Since we call in Pathfinder Second Edition, when I wrote the intelligent weapon rules, we call them like partners with the PCs. We don't call them PC and owner, because an intelligent weapon is a, you know, it's a person, it's a sapient entity.
Unique sapient thing. And so when someone's filling out their character sheet, when they get to the weapon part, they just write me.
Yeah, I think you could. Or if your name is like Maelstrom of the Thousand Storms, then you could write that in weapon. Maelstrom of the Thousand Storms, you know, plus 7, 1d8, plus 4 damage. So we're first level yet.
So it sounds like people are going to be able to apply runes to themselves. Are there going to be other ways that people power themselves up more than just having normal weapons by way of like their heritages? Then it sounds like
you can take ancestry feats to do things that you never expected would be a reasonable or responsible thing for weapons to do, because you're an intelligent weapon. And, like, we'll have a thing in there if the GM wants to say, what if your intelligent weapon PCs are a relic? Do this if you're letting the other PCs also have relics, so it's not just, like, a freebie. But they could be, because relics grow along with the PC. Well, if you are the weapon, then, of course, you can grow along with yourself. So that could be another way to add in even more. If you think, you know, runes aren't enough, these other things aren't enough, let's put more in the weapon so that this really feels like this ridiculously epic weapon that's like, wow, this can do more different things than an artifact. Maybe not some of the more like wildly out there things that an artifact does that are totally unfair, but definitely more different things than an artifact. And sure, you could do that probably with relics, runes, and the feats all sort of combined in there.
So I said that was going to be the last ancestry, but I have one more question about the slimes. The slimes going to get the same kind of bonus with the oozes, where they're pretty much invulnerable to everything, or how are you going to balance a slime ancestry with how they've typically been portrayed as creatures?
Well, that is a very good question. So for that, I think I will go to the Reddit thread and read off a little bit of the lore, because we have some lore from Itheria Nyx, who is an NPC, an advocate of monsters, who thinks the term monster and person are really kind of biased to create in groups and out groups, and doesn't like them. But she has this to say about slimes. Contrary to the belief of those who wish to mock my views with a straw man argument, I don't believe that inanimate or truly mindless beings belong in the conversation about people and monsters. While there is some complexity involved when it comes to vitae, or so-called nature spirits, which can embody even a shrub or a rock and allow a spellcaster to converse with them, nonetheless, it's easier to think of those vitae as separate but connected expressions of the world's life. When it comes to completely mindless creatures, they don't even usually have that much. It might surprise the uninformed that it's possible to even live and act without a mind. But life finds ingenious paths through every possibility. In the case of such beings that lack a centralized mind, each portion of the creature's body serves a purpose towards its conditioned activity, serving as a composite replacement for a brain or mind. Such is the case with the vast majority of oozes, and it is this exact distribution that makes it hard to strike for an ooze's vital. If every ounce of goo within its body can perform all of the same bodily functions as the rest, then quantity matters over quality. It's an interesting defense mechanism against injury, but it ultimately precludes the development of a mind except for in rare cases. There are some oozes, however, which develop a nucleus of sorts, for lack of a better word, core within their body, capable of more than the rest of the ooze. We've come to call those oozes that have a nucleus slime. Slimes are capable of more complex behaviors and special abilities than other oozes, depending on what roles their nuclei develop to fill within the slime's biology. Still, most of them remain mindless, but some slime nuclei develop into their equivalent of brains, granting the slime a conscious, sapient mind. These are initially not as powerful as other slimes, whose nuclei provide a more directly applicable, spectacular, or magical ability, but they wind up becoming much more powerful over time because they can learn, they can grow, and their nuclei can gain more features. Still, they look just like mindless creatures, and most adventurers or travelers are not enlightened enough to be able to tell the difference between an ooze, a slime without sapience, and a sapient slime. Like with so many other things, slimes have been forced to develop a way to bridge the gap for our convenience. Thus, sapient slimes do things like learn how to vocalize our speech, create a rough facsimile of our forms out of goo, and even attempt to use our trappings, for which most slimes normally have no need, such as clothing or gender. That's not to say slimes never desire such things on their own. I know of at least one case where the slime's nucleus awakening to sapience was catalyzed by a partial or complete digestion of another ancestry into the slime, causing the slime to pick up some of that ancestry's sensibilities. Since oozes reproduce by splitting, sapient slimes don't just appear randomly when a slime's nucleus awakens. They can also be the children of other sapient slimes, conscious from the moment of their birth. I've heard that since the convergent evolution of sapients and slimes is slightly different from slime to slime, the newborn slime might be born with a mind that is mostly a copy of its parent slime, or a highly plastic and undeveloped mind like an infant of most other ancestries, or even something else entirely. I must admit, sapient slimes are a new field of study, even for an expert such as myself. If you are reading this, I hope you will continue to study them alongside me, so that we can understand more of their mysteries. Their unusual existence might even hold the key to developing medicines that can help us all live healthier lives. Itheria Nix, Herald of the Space Element, Advocate of Monsters.
Wow, that is some impressive lore that actually, I think, makes complete sense with, you know, how cell structures work, and I think fits very well with the idea of a sapient ooze. So, well done.
And I kind of based the not having a brain off of a jellyfish, which has no central nervous repository system. But each of a lot of the parts of its body are just capable of doing whatever they need to do. It does have, it's not like an ooze in that it does have like the stingers and other things in a jellyfish, but I imagine that an ooze could be even more indiscriminate. It's just like, you just need more ooze and it can all do whatever. So there's nowhere you can hit. Whereas you can hit the nucleus of a slime and it's not good for slimes. Now the rest of them is pretty indiscriminate. So they're not exactly fully exposed to those kind of attacks, but and you might be able to, as you can tell from that fiction, sort of evolve the capacity of your nucleus beyond just sapience to include more powers. And some of those might be a way to protect your nucleus in various ways and become even more resistant to it, more like a slime with no nucleus.
Very cool. So that is a good selection of ancestries. And if you want to find out about the mysterious 12th one, make sure to go and follow the Kickstarter's newsletter so that you can get not only notified about when the Kickstarter goes live, but all these really exciting announcements as they're getting made, because I totally missed.
And the Kickstarter is going live in a week.
Yeah.
On the 26th.
Very cool. So that brings us to our last and for some, perhaps the most exciting aspect of your Kickstarter, which is the completely shameless IP theft of the popular franchise known as Monster Rancher.
Well, I mean, I don't really see it as being IP theft of anyone, but Eldamon is sort of its own thing in the monster training genre.
Sure. So yeah, it's a pretty awesome concept that I never expected to see brought into a TTRPG space, because it just seemed like a really difficult thing to do. Like a summoner with their Eidolon seems like quite a lot to take care of by itself. So tell us a bit how Eldamon work with players, and is there going to also be an aspect for GMs where people are just going to be able to discover new Eldamon as they adventure around in their world?
So I have actually heard of some people who did try to homebrew something like this before in the past, and everything that I heard about those, though, is yes, it is a lot of work, like you said, it's very difficult, but also what came out of it was something that was pretty obtrusive, and either the whole group had to buy in, or at least the GM had to really make an adventure that was entirely tailored to that character, or was it at the very minimum very, very adjusted for that character. On the flip side, there are some that are more bare bones that I've heard about that are more you're just going to catch the monsters from the bestiary. Are those something that are fair for you to have? Probably not. GM, figure it out. But it's a homebrew take, so you're not going to necessarily have the time, energy, and resources to do something that is much more complex than that. What we're doing is going in. And when Steven told me about this, it was months before I actually had to start thinking about doing it seriously. But I was thinking about it in the back burner. Mm-hmm. And my number one for the entire project was, it absolutely needs to not be something that the entire group needs to all be doing, or that the GM needs to disrupt the entire adventure or campaign to be we have to fight against Eldamon and beat them up to...
Yeah.
Or our Eldamon trainer will never get any new Eldamon. So needs to be something you can just throw into whatever you're going to run anyway, or even a published adventure.
Sure.
And so between that and reading and looking at a whole bunch of different media, some of which are not really about monster training, such as sort of like Spren in the Stormlight Archive is one example of this. That's where I came to the idea that Eldamon are sort of phased out in this reality. They normally don't interact with creatures that are phased in directly. So if a fire Eldamon is making fires, it's not going to burn your whole forest down. A wood Eldamon, like if a bunch of them gather together and use their energy, it could like give you good harvests. Like indirectly, they can raise up the elemental energies in their area, and they like to go to places that already have them. But in general, they kind of just meld into an object or a creature or a place, and they hang out. But if something interesting happens, like the creature they're melding in gets defeated, or someone picks up the item or comes to the place, they might pop out and see what's going on. Hmm. And basically, this allows the GM to, if they're willing to trust their player to roll a D100 table and not like make up the results, the GM could have the player do everything and not have to worry about any of it. And it'll all work out, because we're going to put in some tables that you can use as a default, and we'll also put in deep explanations so that GMs who really do want to customize the experience and be like, yeah, I know what the odds are, but your story is that you have this super rare Eldamon that you just started with and nobody knows why. And everyone's like, whoa, you've got this legendary Eldamon at level one. What is going on? Like, you're going to be able to do that any amount that the GM wants to buy in, from basically zero to all the way. And we're just getting badges to try to be masters of Eldamon or whatever like amount that you want to like pastiche it. You're going to be able to do that. And that was very important to me when I was designing it. So I would say that that's what sort of makes it different from other attempts to do some kind of monster training in a tabletop RPG.
Right. So one big part of all of those, you know, kind of animated monster oriented things, Pokemon, Digimon, Yu-Gi-Oh, Beyblade, Bakugan, I could go on, I won't, but
I mean, if you want.
yeah, I could take up the rest of this naming franchises, but it's
maybe you have to do a rap that names all of the franchises, since you told me I have to do an elder rap.
You know,
now
what?
We put it on the stretch goals.
If you reach that stretch goal, I will do that. I will make a pokey.
You'll do the wrap of all the different IPs.
Okay. Card capture. Yeah. But it's the idea of battles. But like, you know, back in the 90s, we didn't really think about it. It was just, you know, like cool monsters. But, you know, as we're starting to grow, it, you know, doesn't seem quite as ethical now. So, but what I understand is that this phasing mechanic seems to be a way to work against that. So tell us a little bit about how you keep that kind of core element of this monster genre, but make it so that it's, you know, not so icky.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, when I was little, I definitely saw some of like the Pokemon anime, for example, and it seems so bright and colorful and cheerful. But when you think about it later on, it's kind of like,
it's like maybe dogfighting.
It's maybe a post-apocalyptic hellscape where there are no trained professionals in fields like policing and medicine, so they have to just clone the same person over and over again. Not much is going on in the city, so everybody is just distracted by preteens who are like dogfighting with these mutant creatures. And it could easily be like a, you know, some kind of a mutant apocalypse setting. Just, we don't think of it that way because it's so cheerful. But with Eldamon, we wanted to sort of avoid some of those connotations right out. And the way we do that is that you do not like beat the crap out of your Eldamon and then force them into a spherical prison and then say, oh, but we're friends now. Instead, you befriend them by learning what they like, and then you can get them to decide they want to join with you. And not only that, when they're fighting, when they're phased out, which is pretty much, if you're not an Eldamon trainer, which is a class that we're putting out, you can still befriend them and they'll follow you around. If you're a wizard or a barbarian, you don't have to take any feats. Can they fight the ogre you're fighting? They can't. They're phased out. They're not going to affect it, but they can sort of play fight each other like dogs who are just fighting for fun. Mm-hmm. And it looks like giant fire blasts, and it is giant fire blasts that are phased out, but doesn't really hurt them. They just kind of get de-energized and kind of slump down, and you know who's won and who's lost. And then they're right back to fine pretty soon after. Now, you can, if you're an Eldamon trainer, actually trade your phase with your Eldamon, phasing yourself out and your Eldamon in to fight that ogre. And in that case, it can get to be actually affected. Although, since it's a being of that other state, some of that, when the Eldamon returns, may pass on to you in order to protect your Eldamon. Okay. Another thing that's good about that is that it also... It's just something that, like, if kids are playing, it's a little less grotesque than, like having their animals be killed.
Right.
but on the other hand, it's got a lot of depth that gamers of all ages are going to enjoy, but sort of trying to put in sort of simplicity and themes so that gamers who have children would be able and happy to, like, have their children who are interested in it play an Eldamon trainer.
Right. So some of the specifics about these Eldamon, there is definitely like some similarities to Pokemon with like the Eldadex, the elements. But there's some really cool parts of it that seem really unique. So looking at the cards that you put up on Reddit, there's a battle form, there's an evolved form, and then there's like a normal form, like a pet. So tell us a bit about how those different kinds of forms will work.
Sure. So for people who are used to Pokemon and some of the others, where you just kind of evolve and then that's it. So if you like the way that Pikachu or Bulbasaur looks, well, it's too bad. If you want them to have the higher stats, you're going to have to evolve them into Raichu or Venusaur.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to Eldamon, though, these are beings that are kind of phased out, and their form is somewhat to an extent up to them. So they just hang out in their pet form most of the time. If they're going to do one of those play battles or you're going to phase them into fight, they'll turn into battle form. That's easy enough. If a trainer works with them hard enough or they get to be pretty ancient, and they meet certain criteria and level requirements, they will gain an evolved form, which sort of replaces the normal battle form and is superior for fighting. And in that case, they'll switch between their pet form and their evolved form when they're going to fight. And they're more fearsome at that point. So mm-hmm. There's a total of three forms, and any given Eldamon is likely to switch between two of them, depending on the situation.
Gotcha. And one other thing that you mentioned was the different kind of elements. So in your Kickstarter, you have some cards coming out: fire and ice, winter, spring, summer, and autumn. I can't read from the pictures what the other subtitles parts of them are, but
spring awakening, summer heat, autumn flurry, and winter wonderland.
Okay, so you're going to have element components to them too. So what are some of the elements that people are going to be able to look forward to?
Okay, well, there's 10 elements that we're guaranteeing are going to be in here. I hope that we get all 20 because they have different play styles I've been thinking about, and I'm amused to do 20 elements. But the 10 you're going to get for sure are fire, water, earth, and air. So they are all in there. Wood, ice, lightning, force, life, and death. Those are locked in. You're definitely going to get all of those. You might also see light, darkness, mind, spirit, body, music, metal, time, space, and poison.
Is it going to work in the same way that we're all used to, where some of them are going to have strengths over other kinds of Eldamon and weaknesses and things like that?
They sure will. They will be particularly strong and weak against other Eldamon of that element. And some of them, if their element is that they're weak to is similar to a damage type, may have a smaller weakness against that damage type in general when you're out adventuring. But like a particular weakness against Eldamon moves that are like of the time element, there's probably not much else that would trigger that, maybe being cast into time. by that one spell from Secret of Magic at the GM's discretion would hit the lower weakness threshold for that. But they will have weaknesses and resistances based on their elements and special moves, special abilities based on their elements that they can learn and use between your Eldamon. And speaking of those special abilities,
yeah,
there's one more thing that's going to be in the Eldamon book in general. I mean, there's more than one more thing. There's sections on putting them in your setting, like how to mesh it in. Maybe they're invisible to most people if you want to explain why you haven't talked about them before. There's going to be a lot of that. But there's one more really big thing, which is the Elemental Avatar class.
Right.
So I talked earlier, where I was just kind of slid in there. They like to like sort of meld into a creature or an item. Mm-hmm. But when we're creating something in fantasy, we want to like think through what are the implications of that. So if an Eldamon stays melded with an item for like centuries, maybe it becomes a relic based on a relic seed that's similar to that element. If it melds into a creature that the GM is controlling, because you asked what about with the GM, maybe like that creature learns one of the Eldamon like special attacks based on its level and its element. But mm-hmm. what if it melds into you?
Yeah.
I mean, your PC. Like, you just were there, and you were minding your own business, and a Lotus Sneck kind of just melded into you at some point, and you may not have noticed, and it's just been there for a while. And it's this wood elemental energy is just coursing through you from the Lotus Sneck within, and you're embodying it as its avatar. You're able to sort of meditate to attune yourself with the Lotus Sneck within. You start being able to manifest wood-based powers that just come out of you. And because of the Eldamon, and you can use those same moves that I mentioned that the Eldamon have yourself. So it sort of lets you be the one who's using it instead of you bringing in a pet to use the ability.
Now, very cool concept, very much like Avatar The Last Airbender. So are people also going to be able to change the kind of elements? Are they going to be able to do more than one? Are they going to be able to be a master of all the elements?
So it's not quite going to be the avatar, the master of all 20 elements. What we've got for you, though, is you're absolutely right to think there must be one more thing. Just like evolving for an Eldamon trainer, mm-hmm. we have another step, which is called transcending. And you can think of that, I mean, it's less of like being the avatar who's one special person who has all the elements that no one else in the setting can do. And I would think of it more as like getting in touch with your Eldamon to the point that you can do something. It's more akin to the avatar state, I guess, in the sense. Although that's a temporary buff. So it's not exactly the same as anything because it's its own thing. But when you transcend, you're either going to learn something deeper about that element that even the Eldamon itself couldn't do on its own, that the two of you are greater than the sum of your parts, or you are going to start be able to bring in things from not every other element, but one second element that doesn't really make complete sense, but that you have somehow managed to make it be from your primary element. So, for example, imagine that my cold elemental avatar is so cold that I can freeze time within certain regions with my ice, and it just like time itself doesn't flow correctly. Now I've got some of the time elemental moves that are just under my cold element for some reason. I just have them. And so you'll get to pick whether you're just the cold person who goes deep into cold or the I am cold, but it's also that, or like my cold is the blizzard winds. And so I change the way that air flows because of the fact that cold air goes down and hot air goes up to create these movements in the air, and I'm taking some air things with my cold, and you make whatever explanation you want, but that you wind up being able to pick in stuff from a second element and adding it to your first one if that's how you choose to transcend.
Now, I figure that Vanessa Hoskins, writer of the Kineticist, might have a word or two to say about having something like this. Wouldn't this kind of step on the toes of having like a elementalist or someone who has nature based powers?
I don't really think so. Although Vanessa did write one of the current like most prominent third party kineticists for Pathfinder's second edition, and she asked me about it on No Direction as well. I think it just means it would be a great party gimmick to have an elemental avatar and a legendary kineticist and an elementalist archetype sorcerer. Get them, and maybe an Eldamon trainer, and have that be your four people. Because, I mean, frankly, like, not only did Vanessa write one of the most prominent PF2 kineticists, right? I wrote the Pathfinder First Edition kineticist, and I can tell you from that, this class is not very similar to the kineticist. Okay.
So you're all going to be able to have, like, a unique place in the party.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty different. Now, obviously, there's, like, you can find parallels between any two classes, especially if they have a similar theme to them in some ways. But the way it plays is going to be very different, because a kineticist is kind of like, you know, Eleven in Stranger Things, like blast, 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 big blast. Oh, my nose is bleeding. They have a playstyle that tends to be to favor repetition of your best combination and having some aces up your sleeve for when you're in a weird situation, and then pushing yourself extra when you're in a hard spot. That's kineticist. Whereas an elemental avatar is kind of getting in tune with these powers from an Eldamon within them that they don't understand, and they are as opposite as you can be while still not using spell slots and even being a little faster and simpler than focus points and resource management in a way that is both interesting and a little easier for, like, if a younger player wanted to play it, they can get into it while a more advanced player can really play around with it. And by that, I mean, they have a rotational playstyle. So you don't repeat your moves. You use, you rotate through your moves and use them at the time that is most advantageous for that one. And then you're not going to be using that one again for a while. So it's almost like the anti-kineticist in a sense, in some ways, right? Because rather than repeating, you
it's not just lightning bolt, lightning bolt, lightning bolt, lightning bolt.
Right. It's like, okay, if I'm the electric one, all right, this time I did the lightning bolt. They were all in a line. I just had to. But now I'm going to use my lightning on the next round to magnetize everybody's armor and give my party, like, a huge bonus to hit these people who are in metal armor. And then on the round after that, I am, because of the fact that there's water that got onto the field from one of my allies, I'm going to, like, charge the lightning into the water and create a hazardous terrain, for people. Or, you know, you'll be shifting around what you're doing rather than, like you said, lightning bolt, lightning bolt, lightning bolt. That's not to say that it's not, like, I am very satisfied and happy with the kineticist playstyle of blasting multiple times. It's not a bad playstyle. I mean, I wrote the class in Pathfinder First Edition, but this class is very different from that and sort of gets the sort of the opposite feel to it.
Right. Very cool. So two awesome new classes, a new archetype. I have one other question as the consummate GM is, will it be, how difficult would it be for a GM to come up with their own Eldamon and introduce them into the game or the world?
I have very good news for you on that, because we're doing a lot of the work here behind the scenes to make things easier for you. That's sort of one of our things that we like to do. And I'm also figured that people want to make their own Eldamon. Like, also, like, you know, your daughter might want to make an Eldamon based on a picture she drew. Mm-hmm. And that we wanted that to be as easy as possible. So a lot of the work is going to be on me making these elements and their special moves. And when it comes to making an Eldamon, that's going to not be that tricky. There's still going to be, like, a few rules you're going to either have to design or strategically pilfer from a similar Eldamon, which shouldn't be too hard to do. But then a lot of it will be, the Eldamon's design will be, like, the art and the flavor. And there's still rules active because, as I mentioned, you need to learn an Eldamon's preferences to befriend it. Like, that's actually important. If you know that Chilot, the little ice otter, likes ghost stories because they kind of hate... They hate Kushtaka, which are, like, evil otters that live in Arctic areas and can't see ghosts at all. And they're like, well, yeah, we love ghost stories and scary stuff. So if you don't design that, then you have to, like, it's not a hard rule. Like, it's not difficult even for, like, a child could design, oh, well, you know, my new one likes peanut butter or something like that. You can design it pretty easily, but you actually, it is load bearing and you do have to design it because it matters to the Eldamon. So it's not like I'm saying that, well, you know, you can design it, but it doesn't really matter. It really matters, but it's easy, if that makes sense.
Very cool. Well, I'm convinced that as poor as I am at this point in my life after just purchasing a house, that this is going to be a really awesome Kickstarter to support. Tell us, what other kinds of things can we expect to see from the Kickstarter? When's it go live? And how can we find out more information about it?
Okay, so we've mentioned a lot of what is in the Kickstarter so far, but there is more to the Kickstarter than that. There are, in fact, two sets of three plushies each for six of the Eldamon, Terrapoof, the Airbat, Squirrelash, the Fire Squirrel, Lotus Snack, the Flower Snake. There's also Boto, the Water Dolphin, Chilot, the Ice Otter, and also a Crystal Cat from the Earth Element plushies. So those will be in there, and the highest tier is going to get them all, and the second highest, you pick which set of three that you want. There's also minis for Eldamon battle forms, which is pretty cool, because like a monster mini, you'll use it as many times as you throw that encounter. A PC mini, you're going to use it with that PC, so that's, you're going to get a lot of use out of a PC mini. With that battle form Eldamon mini, though, you might, if you have multiple Eldamon trainer PCs, you actually might wind up using it across multiple PCs.
Sure.
Just anytime you find that Eldamon. So that's pretty fun. Plus also, like, there's dice sets in there that are like themed after the things you talked about, Fire and Ice and Spring Awakening. And all of those, there's like physical Eldadexes for you, because like Eldadex, the Eldamon index, where you write down your notes about Eldamon, depending on how you choose to put them in your world. Maybe everybody already knows most things about them and there's only a few rare ones that people don't know, or maybe they just sort of showed up and nobody knows anything. But either way, Eldamon trainers or just enthusiasts who don't have the class alike keep a journal, an Eldadex, where they write down like, oh, preferences that they discovered or like abilities or other things. So it's just a physical journal that is really cool, like phoenix and dragon leather covers, and then you can write your notes about Eldamon, or like secret is you write non-Eldamon things in it too for your campaign notes.
No,
and it's still pretty fun. And also there's I think a few other things in addition to that, maybe one or two things, but That's pretty much what we got, and also a bunch of stretch goals that we're hoping to hit some of them. So
yeah.
You can find the Kickstarter on kickstarter.rollforcombat.com, and right now obviously it's a upcoming project page, so you can hit to be notified. Although I recommend, if you want to be notified, going to eldamon.com and signing up for the newsletter, because it has fictions like the one that I read aloud here about the slime, plus like encounters with some of the Battle Zubestiary strange and unusual monsters that our iconics are facing and being like, what even is this thing? Like, they got really confused by the Guiltbound I mentioned before, because they were like, we were with these merchants and the monster just like kind of walked over the merchants and ignored them and only was attacking us. Why is it focused on us? And they never found out it was because they've killed sapient creatures before. And so it couldn't see the other people that they were traveling with. So it's got little stories about that and Eldadex entries in there. The Kickstarter will begin on July 26th, and we'll have a Reddit AMA that is also going to be active on that day. And by we, I mean I'm going to be the one answering that, because I am sure Steven will not be able to do anything but deal with like technical questions and other things from the Kickstarter on launch day.
Yes. You beat me to the punch. I'm very excited that on our Pathfinder 2E, we'll be hosting the AMA with Mark. We'll have a little announcement a couple days before with some more details about the Kickstarter. But make sure to join us on July 26th. From 9 to 5, where Mark will be answering as many questions as he has the physical time and space to be able to answer. I'm sure that there's going to be even more things that you all can bring to the table to ask him that are going to blow all of our minds about this new Kickstarter and all the possibilities that it has to bring to your table. Mark, it has been great to have you for
I have a question for
time.
You.
Yeah.
9 to 5, what time zone?
Pacific?
Okay, great. Yeah. That's my time zone. I like that. I don't want to wake up at 6 a.m. For an Eastern time zone, so that's great.
That would be ridiculous. Yes, Pacific time. Pacific daylight time.
Specifically Pacific
time. So make sure to join us on our Pathfinder 2E. Make sure that you look up the Kickstarter and follow Roll for Combat as well as Mark Seifter on Twitter. I'll have links to their stuff below or in the show notes. And until next session,
don't let the rules rule you.